Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And as you can probably hear, I have been as sick as a dog this week, as we say. And bear with me, please, while I struggle through this week's show. In this week's podcast, we check in very quickly with Troy Hunt from HaveIBeenPwned.com. Troy has done the responsible thing when adding the Ashley Madison dataset to his service. You can only search for email addresses in the dump after you've verified that you, in fact, control them. We'll talk to him about why he did that a little bit later on. This week's show is brought to you by FireEye. Big thanks to FireEye for that. And FireEye senior systems engineer Ben Wilson stops by to have a chat about some neat tricks attackers and malware authors are getting up to with various scripts on Windows, like WMI for persistence. That's a thing now, for example. It's a really interesting chat, and it's coming up a little bit later on. But first up, it's time for a check of the week's security news with the Gruck, who is filling in for Adam Boileau. And Gruck, the Ashley Madison dataset is finally here. After 30 days, the impact team promised they would deliver, and lo and behold, everyone's dirty little secret is now out there.
All right, so this is the sort of the exciting news everyone's got. You know, everyone was saying 30 days ago they don't actually have it, they're not going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And they've done it, you know. Hackers keep promises.
Well, these guys, everything they've said so far seems to have been actually quite accurate, which is interesting.
Right. I mean, the one thing to be aware of is if your data was in the Ashley Madison dump, it's okay because your password was securely hashed, so you don't need to worry.
Was it like bcrypt times 22 or something, right?
Yeah, you know. So I don't know what the big deal is. You know, they don't have the full CC. They've got a strong password protection. It's a bit of a non-story, really.
Yeah, it's a non-story, man. No one's really paying attention. It's really funny, though. Like, some interesting stats that the attackers have come up with is like 90 to 95% of the users are actually dudes. So Ashley Madison used to claim in its promotional material that 50% of its users were women. Turns out that's complete bullshit, which is kind of interesting because these guys were planning an IPO, and you wonder how they would get around yeah. you know the disclosure aspect of that if they did go public.
Right, their numbers would have been out somewhere. Someone would have to do some due diligence. That just wouldn't work. You know, I'm not at all surprised actually that the majority of people on a site looking to go and find something on the side are men. I think that women would approach this differently, not sort of like...
It's more likely to be the yoga instructor, isn't it?
Yeah, like I can't see women going like, how can I buy myself a piece of action?
Yeah. You
know, I can definitely see some guy going like, right, $50, I could get something, boom, I'll have one of those. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can see it, but I think you're right. Like, yeah. If you're speaking in generalizations, it's not exactly a counterintuitive statistic.
5 to 10% of women on there sort of did think like that, right? Or, you know, so obviously some did, but I can see
it rings true, doesn't it? It just sort of rings true. What's interesting though is Brian Krebs actually put up a story that he had to very hastily update, where he interviewed like ALM Media's CTO or whatever, who's like, we have no idea if this is our data. Heaps of people have put up data claiming and of course, you know, they're spinning their way out of this. They're trying to spin their way out of this pretty hard. They've been issuing DMCA takedown notices to people who've been hosting the data, but I mean, it's out, right? I mean, I cannot see Ashley Madison surviving this at all. I think it'll be the site, you know, you'd think will be shuttered by the end of the year.
This is a pretty fatal blow. I mean, their tagline was something along the lines of
anonymous, discreet.
Yeah, you won't get caught cheating.
Yeah. Right?
And that seems to be the opposite of what happened. You got caught even if you weren't cheating. So,
But I got to say, I'm a little bit disappointed in the way that this is being covered, because we've seen, I woke up to a bunch of mainstream media headlines this morning saying, here's how you can search the data. And it's entirely possible that we're going to see a suicide result out of this, maybe even a couple of murders. You know, if you're talking about a data set of tens of millions of people that are now exposed, I mean, statistically, you'd think that's a likelihood, if not a certainty. Right.
Yeah, certainly. Like it's a bit disgusting the way that people go after individual users who are, you know, yes, they're reprehensible human beings, but they're also the victims here. You know, so I don't think I'm not sure.
Man. Look, a lot of marriages survive a couple of affairs. I mean, I'm not married, yeah. So I've never had an affair. But I can imagine if you're married for 20 years and there's one affair, I mean, that is actually kind of the norm. It's something that we don't discuss. You know what I mean? But this is not a hanging offense, you know? Like people, I think people right. don't deserve to have these types of mistakes dragged out into the public arena. I mean, that's just my opinion. A lot of people disagree with that. But people have affairs. Their partner might be in a wheelchair. Their partner might be a complete asshole, but they've got their kids or they haven't had sex in 2 years. I mean, people do this for all sorts of reasons. And now it's become this grab your pitchfork shame fest, you know?
The sort of the internet hate mob is definitely a problem. Mm. I can't really get behind that.
Well, there you go. You heard it first on Risky Business. People on the internet are dicks.
Stop the presses.
Yeah, hold the front page. Look, let's move on, right? Because that's a story right. that's being done to death elsewhere. Microsoft has actually issued an emergency IE patch, and there's not a lot of detail on this one, which is hardly reassuring.
Right. So there's a few interesting things. First of all, the basic news, we've got an IEO day that's being exploited in the wild that has unusually been caught, right? I mean, newsflash, there is always an IEO day being exploited in the wild. Catching them is the exciting thing. So the fact that one's being caught and is being killed, that's good news. The strange thing is no one is taking attribution for that. So, you know, if it was a FireEye or a CrowdStrike or one of these threat intelligence companies,
yeah, we'd see the press release and the swanky name for the bug, you know.
Yeah, there'd be 10 to 20 blog posts about how we did it, the white paper about how we did it, how we could do it for you, why you should buy our blog. And the fact that there hasn't been, it's just been this quiet, you know, it's been found.
Yeah, it screams three-letter agency, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I was about to say, maybe the NSA is actually doing something.
Maybe the NSA is doing something useful. Hey, that's a bit harsh. Apologies to anyone at Fort Meade. You know, we do not mean to impugn you, but, you know, you're kind of a fashionable whipping boy at the moment. So there's that. Oh, now, Andy Greenberg has written up this next piece for Wired, which shows that crackdowns, surprise, surprise, haven't really dinted the online drugs market. It's still worth something like $100 million a year. I mean, I can't imagine anyone's really surprised by that. Drug enforcement hasn't really worked in the real world, and it's not really working online. So, you know, there's that.
Shock. I mean, if you look at the numbers from these crackdowns from Gwern's list, as of May, there were something like 300 arrests total so far for all of the drug markets. You know, over the last few years, there've been 300 arrests. 140 of those are from Silk Road One.
Yeah, right.
So, like, that was the big one. And then since then, there's been a couple of people. So I don't think it's a huge deterrent.
I mean, because especially when it comes to these types of operations where there is that, technologies like Tor giving people a false sense of security and anonymity, no one expects that they're going to get caught. They always assume that they're smarter than that Ross Ulbricht idiot, you know?
Right. The other thing that's came out is the recent paper that showed that the lion's share of all the profits is going to a very, very small number of dealers, and most people are making sort of less than $10,000 total in their careers and stuff. So it looks like there's probably a lot of people who go, this looks really easy. I'll do some of that. And then they get into it. They find out that it's not really working. They get out of it. There's got to be some sort of churn of guys who sort of they think it's easy money because there are those few kingpins really making the millions. They think, I can, you know, how hard is it to ship some envelopes?
Yeah.
Something like half of all of the arrests have been for international shipments of the buyer, right? So you go on Silk Road, you go, I want to sell some cocaine in Australia. I will purchase a half a kilo of cocaine and have it mailed to my house, and then I will sell that and become rich. Yeah. And a half kilo DVD shows up in the mail.
And that's it. Yeah.
Police ring the doorbell. Is this yours? Come with us for a chat, please.
Yeah, absolutely not. I have no idea where that came from. Now, Wired is also carrying a piece about some new Edward Snowden documents that the New York Times has reported on, which detail a somewhat cozy relationship between the NSA and AT&T. Again, not exactly surprising news.
No, this should shock absolutely no one. I think what people have been surprised by, and I'm also a little bit surprised by, is just how deeply NSA and AT&T sort of are in each other's pockets.
But like it's all the telcos, right? Like when this Snowden stuff kicked up, everyone was like, oh, Silicon Valley is like this with the NSA. And it's like, dude, it's the telcos. You know, Silicon Valley is too new, relatively speaking, to have that sort of relationship yet. But all of the telcos are like BFFs with the spooks.
Yeah. So, you know, I think people kind of understand that, you know, if someone shows up with a court order, you're going to do what you can to help them to the letter of the law. And, you know, we'd expect that they wouldn't go the extra mile. And what's a bit surprising is AT&T has really gone the extra mile. You know, I don't think people quite understand just how pro-NSA, pro-spook the telcos are. You know, now we're seeing it from AT&T. It's been sort of documented and proved, and it's a bit surprising. As you say, there's no way out of all of the telcos in the world, there's exactly one bad apple.
Yeah, well, I mean, the relationship is called described as being highly collaborative, right? So they've been doing, yeah, all sorts of stuff together. You can read about that. Link in this week's show notes. Staying in America, and Virginia has dropped 3,000 of these voting machines, the WinVote touchscreen voting machines, based on security grounds. And that's quite encouraging to see a state where, you know, elections are conducted on e-voting machines actually ditching them on security grounds. So that's kind of interesting. Now, Brian Krebs has written up a really interesting piece this week. Genuinely great. It's about this company called Secure Channels Incorporated. And they've been going out making all sorts of outrageous claims about how unbreakable their encryption is and offering, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in prizes to people who can break their encryption, you know, without even opening up the spec or anything. They're just like, decrypt this file and we'll give you money. Of course, no one's done it. So they've just said, hey, see, we did this at Black Hat and it's unbreakable. But Krebs has done a bit of digging on the chief executive of this company and found out that he actually has a bit of a dark history.
Yeah. So, you know, this guy, his former company was a Ponzi scheme. So, you know, there is that.
There is that. He did go to prison also, so there is that.
Yeah. You know, so he's clearly taken what he's learned from running a Ponzi scheme and being in federal jail, federal prison, to now solve security. So,
well, he claims he solved it. So there you go. But no, this company, Secure Channels Incorporated, it looks like the tech. They've actually licensed the tech from some company in, I think, Switzerland or something, or Sweden,
right.
One of the SW countries. And it actually looks pretty good tech. But, you know, to say, yeah, don't say unbreakable. Just don't.
The whole thing is absolutely hilarious as a story, regardless of the quality of the tech. Like, this is all of the things not to do.
Oh, now we've got a couple of interesting, you know, semi-related stories here. One from Ars, one from ThreatPost. A couple of interesting DDoS reflection techniques, different ones. There's one here where you can actually use BitTorrent for reflective DDoS, which is pretty cool, I reckon.
Yeah. So, you know, I think what we're going to be seeing is that this the reflective DDoS seems to be the new thing. Like, it's the new hotness for all of these guys. They're finding ways to sort of leverage their existing botnets to have even more bandwidth by using reflection attacks. So they're going to be going through and finding new sets of protocols constantly. So yeah, there was one recently where they found, and MetalStorm was saying that we're going to be seeing more of these. He's been absolutely prescient. We're now seeing BitTorrent. I don't think this is going to be going away. Literally anything that's on the internet that speaks a protocol is going to be abused for a DDoS at some point.
Yeah, well, I mean, moving to the ThreatPost one, and there's you know, another DDoS reflection attack using an RPC port mapper.
Exactly. Like these. All of these things are used for reflection DDoSes. It's just a way to amplify your existing amount of bandwidth that you're using to attack someone.
And SNMP, NTP, RPC, BitTorrent. Like, it's, and you know, the BitTorrent one's just, you know, straight up UDP, isn't it?
Right. So, like, the BitTorrent one is actually fairly interesting, but on the other hand, UDP tends to be very easy to filter. You know, I think maybe they're just having fun.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's
what can we do with this one?
Why not? Will it DDoS.com? Yeah. Android having a pretty bad week. The Stage Fright patch turned out to be a dud. And there's also a sandbox bypass, which is not so great. So, yeah, another bad week for Android.
The thing about stage fright is I think it's named that because if you look at the code in that library, it is absolutely terrifying. You know, it's made up of 5,000 line, you know, C++ files all over the place. And it's tons of, you know, A plus one dereferenced plus 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 the pointer of something. You know, it's just you look at it and you know it's buggy. There's just no way it's not. But the good news is they have fixed all four of the bugs that actually exist for real this time. So it's completely safe.
Yeah, completely safe. Tell us about this sandbox bypass as well.
Okay, so there's a sandbox bypass. My understanding actually from talking to people is that there's actually a lot of these. There's a lot more than have been patched and that people have found. But I also don't find them that interesting, right? I mean, for me, the scary thing about being on a mobile phone is once you're on the mobile phone, you have access to a lot of things. Sort of a local privilege escalation, which is essentially what a sandbox bypass gives you. It takes you out of the existing sandbox, gives you complete access to the system. That's less interesting to me because you have to get on in the first place and be trapped by that sandbox. So that's a sort of, that's a Java layer.
Yeah, but a sandbox bypass in the context of Android is particularly important because, you know, 9 times out of 10 when something malicious gets onto an Android device, it's a user-installed app from a third-party store.
Right. And
you need Privacy to punch through and get the lot, right?
Right, but I think the problem is these third-party stores. Like Google screwed the pooch when they did that. That was the Apple's walled garden approach that everyone hates has led to exactly zero malicious apps.
Mm.
Right? You know, it's been very good for security.
Well, there've been a couple, man, that got through. Yeah. There have been.
Okay, look, not zero, but
less than Android. Yeah, less than the seething, disgusting cesspool of the Android ecosystem.
If your choices are random Chinese malware, random Chinese app store versus the app store that comes with your Apple device, I will put dollars to donuts on which one is going to give you a virus.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Now, look, just some car hacking news. And apparently that OnStar GM hack that we spoke about, I think it was last week or the week before, apparently Mercedes-Benz and BMWs might be vulnerable to them as well. Why is that?
That's because Sammy Kamkar is absolutely awesome. This guy's a legend. I think the big problem is
The commonality here? Do they use the same tech? I mean, why is this a problem for Merck and Benz when it's a GM system that he was talking about?
Right, so they installed the same shit. The problem is everyone's basically been licensing and using the same sort of tech. And so once it's been hacked somewhere by an absolute legend, it's going to get hacked everywhere using the same techniques. Problem is that there's enough absolute legends out there that, you know, we're all kind of
right. You know, I'm itching for someone to actually start having a crack at the Bluetooth stacks in the head units of modern cars. And the reason I say that is because every car that has Bluetooth hands-free is essentially connected to the internet through the user's phone, right? Through the driver's phone. So if you can find something funky in the Bluetooth stack, and I'm guessing there's like, you know, the 15 manufacturers use something like 3 libraries. Once you can do that, you can get the head unit. Then you can reflash the CAN bus controller and off you go. So there you go. There's an idea for, you know, anyone out there with a not much to do this weekend. There's a malvertising campaign that's affected weather.com, drudgereport.com, wonderground.com, and a whole bunch of other popular websites. It was using Flashbug, right?
Right. So, you know, apparently they've also hit eBay and stuff. These malvertising things are so common, we even have a term for them. If you're not running ad blocking software, you're putting yourself and others at risk. You know, it's not even about supporting websites anymore. It's literally, if you are not running an ad blocker, you are basically barebacking the internet.
What about that's a good way to put it. What about just using, you know, click to play?
Okay, yes. Look, click to play is absolutely fine. You know, that should be your bare minimum. Mm. Maybe you want to support these sites by seeing their text ads. You know, that's fine. so what's interesting is these guys, they have a lot of respect for these malvertising guys because they know what they're doing. They use non-zero-day flash attacks, generally speaking. Like there've been one or two that use zero-day, but usually they use older ones. And the reason that they use older attacks against older bugs is because they know that the boxes that they're hitting are not patched, right? So once they use an old bug to get onto a box,
then they can use an old PrivEsc to root it.
Exactly. It's the cheapest way of going about it. And so for that, I have a lot of respect. It's also, you can't do fingerprinting against old bugs because these guys can use public code. Yeah. Right, so it's not like a Chinese APT that develops all their own stuff by the same four or five guys so that they have a clear signature of their own toolkits. These guys can use publicly available stuff. So on the one hand, it's lame, but on the other hand, it's also, from a security point of view, it's very clever in that they're going after people who are not expensive to attack but are worth pretty much the same amount of money as someone who is expensive to attack.
Mm.
Right, installing onto a Chrome box that's always updated gets you roughly the same $1.50 that installing onto an old IE7.
IE6, yeah, right. Yeah, or IE7, because I don't think IE6 will even work anymore. Thank Christ. Right. Meanwhile, in Italy, some 18-year-old kid found a couple of OS 10 PrivEscs, and he went full disk. I think they're actually patched now in the beta, in the next beta for the next OS 10 release or whatever, but he just, sort of dumped them on the internet, much to Apple's annoyance, I imagine.
Yeah, good on them. The hacker spirit lives on. The young kids are out there still thumbing their noses at the big vendors. And I kind of support that.
You support that. Just go full disk. Just do
just
it.
Just fucking do it.
Yeah.
YOLO. Come on,
YOLO. Okay. Grux says YOLO. So, can't say I'm surprised.
The reason I'm not really that worried about it, I use OS X. I'm not running the betas. I don't actually worry that much about this because it's a single user system. Whether you have root or whether you don't, you still have access to all of my data.
Mm.
Right? That's what people want when they're attacking single user systems, right? It's if you're on a Unix box with multiple users, or you're on a Windows domain controller where you need to get access to, everyone's PC. Like if you're on a multi user system, being able to do PrivEsc is very, very important.
Yeah, but what about persistence, man? If you want persistence on a compromised OS X box, like, can you do that with a user account?
The thing is, persisting on an OS X box is very, very easy because there are so few detection tools out there. Like, there's no AV that's sort of worth running. There's nothing that exists that can give you an extra level of visibility into your magic black box. So there's a lot of techniques that people can do that will allow you to persist on an OS X box without having to escalate.
Yeah.
But there's also so many ways of escalating that one more or less in the public domain.
Not a big deal, yeah. Look, I remember Adam Boilo, Metal, he did a talk at KiwiCon years and years ago, which was because, he does a lot of Unix hacking at work, and quite often his clients, will stipulate in the contracts that they're not allowed to escalate privilege. So he'd need to come up with some really creative ways to get persistence on Unix user accounts and also hide the persistence. And he basically did this presentation with all of his party tricks, and they were pretty awesome. They were actually really awesome. So, hiding processes and shit just with really dumb tricks that shouldn't work but do. And you're just like, oh, man, that's pretty clever. He's good hacks, good hacks, good hacks.
Metal is pretty good at computers.
Yeah, he is. Well, Grok, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us and filling in for Adam. And we will chat to you again soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, talk to you later, man. See ya.
That was the Grok there with a chat about the week's security news. He was filling in, of course, for Adam Boileau, who is back on deck next week. He's taken the week off to go to his company's annual RoachCon, Insomnia Security's annual RoachCon event, where they all get together, and they're no doubt having quite a good time right now. Okay, it is time for a quick chat now with Troy Hunt, a Pluralsight author who creates secure development training. He also administers HaveIBeenPwned.com. Now, Have I Been Pwned is one of these websites where you can plug in your email address and see if it shows up in any of the massive data dumps that have come out over the last couple of years. It's yet another iteration of, similar services like shouldichangemypassword.com. But if you're Troy, how do you add the Ashley Madison dataset and, not have your website be the hub of a pitchfork-studded free-for-all? So how do you stop all and sundry from just phishing the dataset for the addresses of people they know? How do you stop yourself from contributing to the public shaming of people? What if an affected user commits suicide? Well, Troy figured out a nice solution that he could live with. Here he is.
Going back to when the original news broke, and so this was about a month ago, and the attacker said, hey, we're going to dump this data if you don't take the site down. Now, clearly the site was never going to go down. So I gave it a lot of thought at the time, and I wanted to make the data searchable by those who've been impacted, because we know how poor organizations are at actually letting people know that their data was in a breach. But, you know, as you say, that the suicide thing, and that was what popped into my mind, I don't want to find out that some guy's been, you know, found hanging in his garage or something, and it's haveibeenpwned.com on his computer screen at that time. Now, look, the data will be searchable publicly via other places, not just the torrents. There will be other websites stood up.
Yeah.
And you can
find it.
But
the point is, don't be that guy, right?
That's it. And I saw you make that comment today on the Twitters, and that's exactly it. I don't want to be the one that's in that position where it's been me that's been the channel. Let someone else be that guy. So what I decided to do with it is I said, look, you know, there's a mechanism in there already where people can sign up for notifications, and it's, you know, it's all free. I'm not harvesting addresses, and they'll get an email when stuff appears. So let's use that. And this time when you sign up and you verify your email address, you can see every account, not just the very public ones, but the Ashley Madison one as well. And if you're already signed up, you get an email address. So basically, the only way you're going to see this data is if you have actually verified your identity, and I can have a pretty high degree of confidence that it is the person who owns the account that's seeing it.
Yeah, look, it seems like a reasonable measure to me. Let me ask you about Have I Been Pwned? I mean, is this a for-profit venture, or is this a hobby? Like, what's the reasoning behind it?
Look, it kicked off around about the time of the Adobe breach, because it was just interesting how many people I was seeing across multiple data breaches. And I thought, hey, it'd be kind of neat if people could see just how broad their exposure is. And it also gave me a good chance to play with a bunch of Microsoft Azure bits and pieces that I was doing a bunch of work with. So I've run it entirely not for profit until very recently. And the only thing that's actually changed there is I've got a service where organizations who are providing things like fraud protection or identity theft protection can monitor the individuals in their subscription and get told, for example, when they appear in Adobe or something like that. So
that makes sense, right? That's like a nice little side earner, I'd imagine.
Yeah,
eventually it could be, maybe.
Oh yeah, look, it'll grow into things. But look, honestly, it's not the sort of thing I really want to set out to monetize for the hilt. I think it does a good service for people who otherwise wouldn't have known the breadth of their exposure. And look, if it helps people out, and if some people want to pay a little bit of money to get something on a more enterprisey kind of level, then great.
Troy Hunt, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about the Ashley Madison dataset.
Thanks, mate.
That was Troy Hunt there, and sadly, not everyone has been so responsible. I woke up to a bunch of headlines in the mainstream media today screaming, hey, here's how you can search the Ashley Madison dataset. Site owner ALM Media has had a few of the search sites pulled offline with DMCA requests, but there are zillions of sites springing up. But hey, at least Troy isn't that guy. So good on you, mate. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ben Wilson of FireEye, makers of fine security technology. In addition to the gateway solutions they make, they also make a nifty endpoint client. And geez, it'd have to be nifty with some of the tricks that attackers are getting up to these days. Scripting tricks in particular are very popular right now. Things like WMI, macros, and PowerShell, they've been around for a long time, but attackers are really embracing them at the moment. So I got Ben on Skype and started off by asking him to tell me what attackers are actually doing with scripting tools and languages in 2015, and here's what he had to say.
Yeah, so I guess that's probably a two-part answer to that. So the first one is, I guess, why are attackers using these? And the second part is how are they using them? So I guess the why, you know, a big part of it is that these techniques help attackers stay under the radar, right? So once they've compromised an endpoint through a successful exploit or whatever it may be, they want to stay on the down low. And a really good way of doing that is to use scripts for their lateral movement, for their persistence on a particular endpoint as well.
Yeah, well, I nearly had an embolism when I saw a talk on PowerShell once. That was interesting.
Yeah. It's quite amazing what you can do with it. And we were talking, I think, off air before about the stuff that Paul Craig did at KiwiCon back in 2008, building a full WMI-based backdoor. And that, to me, is pretty interesting. And we've definitely seen that technique adopted and used in real-world attacks.
Yeah, it's funny that it took this long, to be honest. Do you know if they actually used any of Paul's scripts, or did they just roll their own?
I haven't seen any using specifically parts out of his scripts, but the technique and the principles he applied absolutely have been used. And so we've seen, for people who aren't familiar with how the WMI stuff works, basically what it is, it's a service that runs on Windows. It's there by default, and you can connect to it locally or remotely with if you've got valid credentials. What it is an event-based service, so you can trigger an action based on a particular event. So, for example, an event may be a file being written to a particular directory, and the action might be to push that to the attacker's command and control or exfil point as the action to take on that. And so the reason it's so effective is because this sits in a proprietary database that no one's really even bothered to reverse engineer and figure out how it works so far. So this is not sitting in any plain files on disk that's easily identifiable by your normal forensics processes or your sweeping processes that are out there.
Nice old opaque format.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've seen, the WMI stuff absolutely used. In this, we've got some of our guys from our Flare team have released a really good sort of 100-page primer on WMI and its use in these sorts of things just recently.
100 pages isn't a primer, it's a manual, my friend.
Well, yes. They've done a fair bit of research in this area. And part of that is because it's an interesting area, but because we have seen it used in these real-world attacks. And, we are going to probably have some more details about some of that we'll be putting out tomorrow as well.
There's a particular malware family that's using this, isn't there?
So we've seen particular threat groups in particular use this WMI-based techniques. There is a malware family called Powlix that uses a similar but different technique. So it's not using WMI per se, but what Powlix does, and it's using this technique, which is fileless. So from a forensics and discovery perspective, it breezes right through things like your traditional AV because there is no file on disk.
Yeah, it just sort of writes it into the config, does it?
Yeah, so the way Powlix actually works, did a talk on this with Ruxmon back a few months ago called Registry Inception, and because what it's actually doing is there's a registry key that contains some embedded JScript, and that JScript is called on startup into the WScript process. And embedded inside that JScript is a PowerShell script. And it's even nice enough that if you don't have PowerShell installed for any reason, it'll silently download and install it for you.
Nice.
Very helpful. And then embedded inside that PowerShell is a DLL, which is reflective DLL process injected into a legitimate Windows WinDLL process.
So where's the data that's injected into the DLL stored, though?
It's stored, so the DLL itself is encoded inside the PowerShell script.
Oh,
so
wow.
it's actually extracted from this PowerShell script inside this JScript, and this is all done in memory, mind you. It's Base64 encoded inside the PowerShell, and the PowerShell itself is encoded inside the JScript as well. So, we've got multiple layers of unstacking. So it is this sort of nesting of this stuff. And so, again, from a discovery perspective, it's really hard. I mean, we have some really good indicators for this. So first time I came across Powlix, we actually hit on some indicators on this because in our MVX-based products that look for this stuff inside the virtual machines and also in our endpoint products that's looking for indicators of compromise, we actually had an indicator in there for looking specifically for registry run keys that start with WScript, call encoded script after it.
Yeah, so, right. So does that catch anything legitimate or is that always bad?
No, that's pretty much always bad. I mean, there may be some very edge use case where that stuff, there is a legitimate reason for doing it.
And they're the ones that are going to make some of your users cry. You know that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same with this WMI stuff. I mean, that's the problem. It's dual-use technology, right? So you've got to be – it's a difficult thing to ascertain whether something is a legitimate script or doing something malicious. And I've even, played around with some of this stuff, and there's plenty of scripts that come – packaged with Windows, for example, and are set in if you ever fired up the sysinternals tool auto runs on a default Windows box, you'll see there's a VB script that's in there. It's disabled, but it's inside the Windows directory. I mean, that's a great place to place a persistent mechanism, right? Because it's already there and no one's going to go looking for it.
Nonetheless, though, I mean, you're going to need some sort of exploit and maybe some privesque to be able to be into a position to stuff all of this crap into the registry in the first place, aren't you?
Yeah, look, that's entirely goes back to, like I said, FireEye's perspective on catching a lot of this stuff too. You know, it's about catching the stuff at the exploit phase is critical. Reason being that most of this, the stuff we see, especially the more advanced stuff these days, every other phase gets harder and harder to detect. So, you know, example is your exploit triggers and your shellcode may just call URL download to file and pull an exe over the wire, but more often than not, it's going to do some sort of encoding of that file before it pulls it down. So, you know, good luck with your sort of network layer tool that's trying to sniff executables off the wire and drop them into a sandbox.
Yeah.
It's going to completely miss this sort of thing. And then the callbacks as well, we're seeing getting harder and harder to detect because they're being pushed into legitimate cloud-based services or they're compromising legitimate websites and using those for their C2 and exfil points. So, you know, catching the later phases gets really hard, but if you can catch that first exploit, you can actually unfold everything that it does after that. So you can go, that's interesting, i.e. just, you know, wrote to this registry key that it doesn't normally write to, and put this data in there, that's something from a behavioral perspective that you can very quickly identify and get some really good actionable alert detail out of.
Look, it is a myth too that incident responders will always find point of entry, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know I've you know, seen, for example, attackers, once they get the foothold, it's very hard to find where they are. You know, I saw in one case where they embedded their backdoor inside the gold disk images that the organization would use to rebuild its machines.
Oh, nice.
You know, pre-owned ISO image.
Yeah.
So stuff like that happening makes it really difficult. And, you know, we talk about the IR. When we go in and do this as under the sort of Mandiant guys, our average time frame is 209 days from when the initial compromise is sort of backtracked to when someone actually realized there's something wrong and raise the alarm. So that's a lot of time for these guys to be hanging around in your environment.
Now, of course, you know, another sort of old school scripting method that's made a comeback lately are macros, and in particular macros in viruses in, you know, Word documents and things like that. They're making a bit of a comeback as a means to defeat technology, sandboxing technology like the technology that you guys make. So there's things like the run-on-close macros, which sort of fools some of the sandbox technology because, you know, you spin up this VM, you know, run the file, wait a little while, then blow it away, you know, not always closing that file and then observing what's happening. What are you guys doing to get around that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing a real uptick in these. You know, anyone who lives in Australia has probably seen or at least knows someone who's received one of these emails purporting to be from Australia Post or the AFP or a parking infringement notice. And a lot of these are this Drydex malware, and its approach is macro-based attacks, so there's no real exploit per se. It's more social engineering. And if you've ever looked at any of these samples, the Word document often has instructions with a little arrow pointing up saying, you know, click this enable macros button to read the content of this document, things like that. So it's very good at fooling, you know, your unwitting end user of a computer system. The way we actually handle this is there's probably several layers to it. You know, we've got a team that works on counter evasion techniques, and attackers it's always a cat and mouse game with trying to evade sandboxes and things like that. We do, I think, a pretty damn good job of it. So, you know, we're aware of a lot of the techniques, such as, you know, macros that only run on close. And so within our sandbox, we do automatically actually close the application to catch those sorts of things. And we have a lot of other evasion techniques that, you know, I can't delve into specific details on, but we certainly catch a heck of a lot of this stuff. And where we're sitting in our in these environments is underneath all your other security controls, so underneath your mail filtering and AV level, and we're actually still catching a ton of this stuff. So it is obviously very effective at getting through your traditional security controls, and sandboxing is a really good way to discover it.
So where to from here in terms of detection? Because, you know, I understand that it would be an effective way to discover it is with the sandboxing techniques, but it's not going to be 100% effective. You know, you mentioned before that there hasn't been a lot of reverse eng go into this, you know, into these some of these funny database formats used by Microsoft to store a lot of this scripting information and event-based scripts and things like that. Do you think there needs to be more research in that area? To open that up so that security companies like yourselves can actually start building tools to look for dodginess?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, my view on this is that we need to be better at sharing a lot of these techniques as defenders. Attackers are obviously highly effective at sharing techniques with one another and quickly adopting new techniques. And so I think we need to take the same approach in defense.
Should Microsoft actually be giving more support to the security community to understand these formats, do you think?
Look, I think where they can, absolutely. I mean, we've got some guys who work in our FLAIR team, which is the FireEye Labs Advanced Reverse Engineering, a guy named Matt Graber, who is a guy I've long followed for his excellent PowerShell blog and things like that. He's actually just been speaking at both Black Hat and DEF CON with a number of other guys and talking about some of these WMI-based attacks. And he's also, we've actually released, if you go and have a look under GitHub, under the FireEye account under GitHub, we have a bunch of tools that they've just released that actually help people investigate this. So they've actually reverse engineered the database that WMI is stored in, so you can actually go through and start doing some analysis on this stuff yourself. And sweeping for some of this stuff, I think we're going to see more and more of that come into endpoint agents such as the FireEye HX agent, where you're going to start looking for these sorts of indicators as well.
All right, well, I'll be sure to include a link in this week's show notes to that GitHub page. Ben Wilson, thank you very much for joining the show.
Pat, that's my pleasure, and I look forward to listening to your show as always, mate.
FireEye Senior Systems Engineer Ben Wilson there. Big thanks to him for that very interesting chat. And that is it for this week's show. No feature track this week. I couldn't think of anything and I need to go lie down. But I hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.